Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. As has become tradition for Insights Now, for our final episode of the season, we'll reflect on some of the most important takeaways from the 6 episodes we recorded. This 13th season was all about the research backing our portfolio managers' investment decisions. We sat down with our best-in-class buy-side equity research analysts from across JP Morgan Asset Management, exploring a range of sectors, including semiconductor, payments and fintech, industrials, utilities, healthcare, and financials. And I'm thrilled to be joined by David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist, as we review the most memorable parts of the wide-ranging conversations we had. I will also ask David the top 3 most popular questions we're getting from clients, which, no surprise, tend to focus on aspects of economic policy coming out of DC and their potential economic and market impacts. And if you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning in to our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked in the show notes. Now, let's get started. David, welcome to Insights Now.
Glad to be here. You were the one who was putting these questions to all these equity research analysts, so I thought it's only fair to start by asking you a whole pile of tough questions.
Fair enough.
So the first question is, what was your takeaway in terms of what it's actually like to be a research analyst?
Yes, and I was so interested in that, because what is a day in the life like? And some of the main takeaways across the different sectors is, first, it's a 24/7 job just to keep up with all the relevant data that's relevant to their sector, the companies they follow, and that it's truly a global effort. So we were talking, you know, to Eric Granati of Semiconductor, saying he wakes up at 4 a.m. every day to see what happened in Asia. There's lots of supply chains that pass through Asia and innovations that happen there. Or, for example, talking to David Chan about payments and fintech and how he keeps up with trends around the world, like in Brazil. So it's very interesting to see how truly global research has to be, really. I think it's also interesting that there has to be a passion in that sector. You know, you have to have something that gets Teresa in the morning to think about utilities and how they're doing in different states with different dynamics happening. And lastly, that there's no one day in the life, really. It's kind of a mixture of being here at the office, working on models, talking to other research analysts, but you also have to go to industry conferences, you have to go see companies, you have to go see power plants, you have to speak to doctors. Just sounded really fascinating, really exhausting, but really fascinating as well.
It actually sounds like it's very like a global strategist, except at a micro level.
We have
all those things, but it's just all about the big macro
picture. The big picture. So great to see the bottoms-up picture, too.
So I guess another question is, you know, as you talk to these analysts, were there some common themes that were sort of really moving through all of your conversations with them in terms of how they analyze companies right now?
So I think it's interesting. You know, there's some attention to where we are cyclically in terms of the economy and earnings growth, different dynamics in their sectors, but so much more focus on long-term trends. And across sectors, this huge innovation we're seeing, artificial intelligence, was by far and away the main takeaway. And you saw that in sectors that are benefiting from the physical infrastructure build-out for all these data centers to process these LLMs, going, of course, semiconductors, but also an exciting theme in industrials and utilities, especially for our growth managers. But it was also present across the board in other sectors that are racing to adopt AI, either for efficiency or to gain new products for their end customers, and hopefully they're willing to pay up for it. I thought the most promising one, not here and now, but what's to come, was healthcare. So talking to Holly Morris about, you know, right here, right now, a lot of healthcare companies are using this more for cutting down costs eventually when there's a little bit more digitalization of healthcare records. They're using it for automation, for example, surgical robotic companies. But the really exciting long-term trend is, can you use large language models to end up with hyper-personalized therapies for each individual? And that seems really, really exciting and promising.
Interesting. And I also know that as literally real time, as you're recording this season, there's a lot going on in the policy outlook here in the United States. So to what extent were your conversations and is their research being impacted by the changing policy outlook and also what that, of course, means for the short-term economic outlook?
Yeah, and for some, you know, for a lot of our research analysts, the focus was on the long-term trends, but being aware of the here and now and potential policy changes. I think nowhere is that more true than in healthcare, where the sector has had a persistently large discount to the broader market because of varying, changing regulatory overhangs. And for this administration, it's been a certain amount of focus by RFK Jr. on certain types of foods, for example, and what that means for certain diseases. It's also been, will the administration provide certain amounts of Medicare, Medicaid support for GLP-1 drugs? And then lastly, will there be a focus on pharmaceutical prices? So healthcare, as usual, the main candidate. The second one, I think, was financials. So a big focus on what's being seen as a more deregulatory push in the sector and how that could free up a lot of capital for large banks, especially to lend, especially a focus on C&I loans. And then lastly, utilities. Teresa talked about how she interned on Capitol Hill and that way grew very, very passionate about politics, except that the nuance is for utilities, it's not federal politics that matters, it's state and local. And so following what's happening in New Jersey, in Alabama, is very, very important to her more than following the change at the federal level.
Okay. All right.
Your turn, David.
Yeah, all right. I'm ready.
All right. What about you? Speaking of policy, we've been getting a lot of questions from clients about different aspects of the new administration and Congress. And of course, top of mind recently are tariffs.
Yeah.
And who knows what will happen the next couple of days. But in general, how do you think about where we could be with tariffs, how it compares to, for example, what we saw during the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and how that impacts your economic outlook?
Well, first of all, I should say at the outset that as an economist, I don't like tariffs. I think most economists don't like tariffs. Milton Friedman didn't like tariffs. Ronald Reagan didn't like tariffs, for that matter. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an economist. But the problem with tariffs is they tend to raise prices, they cut employment, they hurt productivity, they increase inequality, they increase global tensions, they slow growth. I mean, it's really a very backward-looking, destructive economic tool. I've often said it's kind of like, it's like using a grenade in a small room as an offensive weapon. I mean, it's not going to work. It causes a lot of damage without much doing any much good. You can use tariffs to try to convince other countries to cut theirs. And if tariff is being used as a threat to try to get to a zero-zero tariff equilibrium, that's a good thing. And so we'll have to see how this plays out. I still have some hope that at the end of the day, we'll end up with lower tariffs. But what we've seen so far as we're recording this, and I think we're going to have to date stamp this in order to make sure that, this is, what is it, April 10th today?
It is.
April 10th.
April 10th.
All right. Well, we're going to date stamp on April 10th because as of right now, where we are is the president has put a 90-day pause on the tariffs that he's the sort of general reciprocal tariffs, but he still has a huge tariff on China at 125%, and then special tariffs on steel and aluminum, on imported vehicles. So there's a lot of tariffs out there. Overall, I would say that the overall level of these tariffs at this stage is comparable to what Smoot-Hawley was. But it will probably have different effects on the economy. I mean, the important thing, of course, is Smoot-Hawley was put in the middle of the Great Depression, and the economy had a lot of big problems otherwise, which were slowing it down. We went into this year with an economy which is, post-cyclical. It was pretty stable. It looked like 2% growth, inflation coming down 2%, unemployment low at 4%. It was a pretty stable, chugging along economy. So it wasn't nearly as damaged when this happened. And I think that means And the global economy wasn't as damaged as when this happened. So to that extent, Smoot-Hawley was the straw that broke a lot of camels' backs around the world. I think that the global economy, U.S. economy, is a little bit more resilient right now. On the other hand, I have to say that it was a simpler age back then. You go 100 years ago, we didn't have all these incredibly integrated supply chains all over the world. I mean, you stop the importation of wheat or grain or sending steel maybe around the world. But these were relatively straightforward products. I'm hard-pressed to find any product in this office as we're recording this year which doesn't include, say, a Chinese component somewhere. And even when you get to, you know, components which seem to have a label from one place, they're affected by supply chains elsewhere. It also has a huge effect on uncertainty. You know, because, again, back then, it was a simpler economy, so you could make decisions. Now it's causing, I think, a freeze on certainty overall. So it's, I think, in one sense, it's I think the economy can stand a bit better, but I think it's equally destructive. And honestly, Smoot-Hawley tariffs are a bad idea. These tariffs are a bad idea, and I hope that we end up using trade policy to try and bring other people's trade barriers down, not to push up trade barriers ourselves.
And it's not going to fix our deficit problem.
No, that's right. I mean, first of all, a trade deficit is really a symptom rather than a disease. It's kind of like when you have a temperature. You know, when you're ill, I mean, it's bad that you have a temperature, but that's really not the problem. The problem is because of the virus. And a tariff is a solution is like taking a kid with a temperature and throwing them out in the snow to see if you can get them to cool down. It's not a great idea. But no, the reason we have a trade deficit is not because everybody's being mean to us or even their trade barriers. I mean, we have some trade barriers ourselves, non-tariff trade barriers. And two big reasons are, one, the dollar's been too high for way too long. Our stuff is expensive and everybody else's stuff is cheap. And we've contributed to that. We've talked about a strong dollar for a long time. And I think that's made that problem worse. The second thing, though, is we've got a big budget deficit. And there's a very simple equation in economics. I think I learned it my second day in macroeconomics class, which is that if a government spends beyond its means, if government spending exceeds taxes and the private sector pays its own way, so private investment equals private savings, then the nation will live beyond its means. And overall, that means imports must exceed exports. So the big thing that's happening here is we're generating all this excess demand out of the government sector. And since the private sector is not as far out of whack, that demand is flowing through to the whole country buying other people's stuff. In other words, if you want to fix the trade deficit, I mean, I don't think it's that important to fix the trade deficit. There are other things to fix. But if you want to do it, fix the budget deficit first. That will fix the trade deficit.
And that is actually the second main question we're getting from clients, mm-hmm. is around the budget deficit. What about some of these recent efforts from DOGE, for example, to cut costs, especially by laying off federal employees? How do you see that having an impact on the deficit and the economy overall?
Well, it certainly is bravery to some extent on the part of the administration to do this. And I suppose any serious attempt to reduce the deficit, I have a hard time being too angry with people about, you know, taking tough decisions. So it's not popular, but we are seeing these cutbacks. But I think it's important to realize that the federal government is mostly just a funnel to take taxpayer money and send it out in grants and loans and payments to states and Social Security and Medicare and so forth. The actual employment within the federal government, there are only 3 million federal employees, including the 600,000 who work for the Postal Service, the 3 million civilian federal employees. There are 20 million state and local workers, including all the teachers. And then there are 150 million workers overall. So it's only about 2% of U.S. employment. It's not that big. I do think that they will succeed in reducing the federal employment roles by about 10% this year, go from 3 million down to 2.7 million. If you did it carefully, it's probably a good thing. I'm afraid there's a lot of sort of sledgehammer approach to it, which means that mistakes are being made. And you also have to think about how kind or cruel it is, the way they're doing it. And that's, to me, that's a very important thing. You have to be good to and fair with federal employees. But beyond that, it's not enough in terms of the deficit. The deficit this year, the fiscal year, is going to come in at about $2 trillion. If you look at the average federal employee and say they make 100,000, maybe a little bit more than that a year, but roughly 100,000. If you got rid of all 3 million of them, that saves you $300 billion. Again, the deficit, $2 trillion. So it saves you 1/6 of the deficit. You really can't fix the deficit unless you're willing to increase overall levels of taxation and cut spending. Both. You have to do both. And so I don't think it's going to make a dent in the deficit in the long run. I think, you know, if we even just extend the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, if we do nothing else, we just extend that, then according to the Congressional Budget Office, the trajectory in the debt is going to go from about 100% of GDP right now to about 130% of GDP 10 years from now. And no amount of DOGE cuts is going to change that.
Mm-hmm. And we're not firing 3 million federal employees.
No, and I certainly hope we don't, because, you know, I think that, again, very often I hate it when we sort of scapegoat the wrong people for what the problems are. There is a problem. We, the voters, are unwilling to elect anybody who says they're going to raise taxes, and we're unwilling to elect anybody who says they're going to cut spending. Well, what do you think is going to happen to the deficit then? It's, you know, voters need to have the backbone to vote for people who stand on principle and who are willing to do the right thing for the country in the long run and not just the right thing politically for them in the short run.
Yeah, and there are no easy solutions.
Yes.
Speaking of a different part of D.C., the third most popular question we're getting is about monetary policy.
Yeah.
So what do you think the Fed is likely to do this year in terms of interest rates and their balance sheet?
It's very, very complicated. First of all, I think actually the simpler part is their balance sheet. They have been reducing their balance sheet. They are slowing the pace at which they are reducing the balance sheet. And I think that they will essentially bring that to a halt at some stage over the course of this year. What that really means is they think there are ample reserves in the system, but they don't want to push their luck here. So I think their balance sheet they've been bringing it down. I think they're going to just sort of level out. But the real issue for them is monetary is policy in terms of interest rates. And the next meet on May 7th, we'll have to see how that plays out. I think the economy is going to be weakening, which will give them a reason to cut maybe 25 basis points. But they're also going to be looking at the prospect of higher inflation from tariffs. I think if it was just tariffs, what we're going to do is we're going to get a cut maybe on May 7th, maybe another one in June. And I think the Federal Reserve will cut significantly over the course of this year, because if it's just tariffs, that will slow the economy down. The DOGE cuts we just talked about slow the economy down. Actually, the immigration reduction also slows the economy down, although nobody wants to see huge, you know, really unregulated immigration in huge numbers. We need to have some sort of balance here. But all those things are slowing the economy down. And if it was just tariffs, we know those push up prices in the short run. But then once the price level has gone up to a certain level, it stops. And if the tariffs, along with everything else, slow the economy down, then inflation will begin to diminish again. So if it was just that, the Fed would quickly pivot to trying to deal with the real economy. I think you get more cuts later on in the year. If, on the other hand, we get a big dose of fiscal sugar and some stimulus bill to try and goose up the economy in 2026 ahead of the midterm elections, the Fed's in an excruciating position. They don't want to, you know, if we've got well above target inflation this year and we're going to have well above target inflation next year because of fiscal stimulus, they don't want to enable the federal government to make the deficit even worse and to push inflation even higher. So I think the Fed will want to wait and see. They may give us a token rate cut in May or in June, but they're going to want to see the direction of fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. There is one other thing that I think is important here. I do think that fiscal policy, in terms of particularly of one-time checks like a DOGE dividend, is a powerful stimulant. It can both push up growth and push up inflation. It's done that before. It could do it again. And I do think that a pivot on tariffs, if we got to a zero-zero solution, that would be a tremendous boost to U.S. economic growth. Really would be a great thing to do that. But I don't think that interest rates can stimulate this economy. If the day the Federal Reserve cuts 50 basis points, 75 basis points, 100 basis points, that's the day the stock market is down a lot and the economy is getting into trouble. The Fed can't rescue the economy from the effects of other policies here. So, you know, I'm sure the Fed's view is let's at least do no harm. And that's why I think they're going to wait until they really have some clarity on policy from the other side of Washington.
Yeah, even the Fed, very reactive to what's happening from the executive and legislative branch.
Yeah.
Thank you, David. And thank you for joining today for our Season 13 Wrapped episode. This episode marks the end of Season 13 of Insights Now, but don't worry. We'll be back soon with a rapidly evolving policy, economic, and market backdrop. 2025 should continue to be an exciting year with plenty to discuss. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today, and speak with you soon.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.